Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1018, Baba Ramdev and Hindutva Fascism, part 1. This is being recorded on August 7th of the year 2018. In this program and in the next program, 1019, Baba Ramdev and Hindutva Fascism, part 2, we are obviously, once again, going to be revisiting the subject of Hindutva fascism or Hindu nationalist fascism. We have talked about this in many programs, For the Record, 795, 988, 989, 990, 991, 992, and 1015. And we also touched on it in 1016 as well. India is not far behind China as the most populous nation on Earth, and it also is a nuclear power, and something that we are going to talk about probably in part two concerns India's position on the Earth Island. And we're going to talk about some of the larger implications of the geopolitical and geostrategic implications of having a form of fascism taking hold in India. I want, however, to focus on India proper, at least initially. Not only is the very size of India, but its nuclear status worthy of attention when a nuclear country goes fascist, and when a country that is the second most populous country on Earth with approximately a sixth of the Earth's population, you want to pay attention to that. Plus, there are a number of very important ideological similarities between Hindutva fascism and fascism as it is manifesting in the U.S., in Europe, and other places. Not only the corporatist economics of Baba Ramdev and the BJP and the RSS, not unlike the corporate state of Mussolini, the corporatist economics adopted by the Muslim Brotherhood and other forms of fascism, but the invoking of an idealized and largely mythical past which is to be restored into the present. It is true in Hindutva fascism, or it is characteristic of Hindutva fascism, and is also very much present in other forms of fascism as well. We highlighted this in among other programs, For the Record 1013, Fascism and the Politics of Immigration. We are going to come back to that invocation of an idealized mythical past, and at the same time, the demonization of the other, unquote, the focusing of anger for the corruption of society on a malevolent other. It varies from form of fascism to form of fascism. In Nazi Germany, of course, primarily Jews, but others, Gypsies, gays, and others. In the Islamic fundamentalist fascism of the Muslim Brotherhood, it is Jews, Christians, and, quote, infidels in general. Here in the U.S., we are hearing all about immigrants, unquote, be they Latinos or Muslims or whoever. In Europe, Muslim immigrants are largely being demonized. Muslims are a focal point of the ire, the ideological ire of Hindutva fascism as well. Now, we have spoken about the RSS. That is a Hindutva fascist organization formed in 1925 by V.D. Savarkar. Its principal leader was V as in Victor, D as in David, Savarkar, S-A-V-A-R-K-A-R. It was modeled after Mussolini's black shirts. It formed links, as we will review, with European fascism. It was the RSS and the closely linked Hindu military organization, the Hindu Mahasabha, that murdered Mahatma Gandhi. We looked at that in, for the record, 988 and 989. I would note that the rise of Narendra Modi and his BJP, again, a political front for the Hindutva fascist RSS, was effected in considerable measure with financial aid from Pierre Omidyar, the Baron of eBay, who also, and we will come back to this, helped to finance the rise of the OUNB successor organizations, which are in charge of much of the activity in Ukraine as well. Of course, Omidyar and his First Look publications, including The Intercept, became the repository for the cachet of documents that were leaked by Edward Snowden, and perhaps the best known of the, quote, journalists, unquote, operating under the auspices of First Look Media and The Intercept is Glenn Greenwald, in, for the record, 888 Citizen, a compendium on Citizen Greenwald. We took a look at the career of Glenn Greenwald. He basically, for all intents and purposes, is a Nazi lawyer. Before he became a journalist, he was a lawyer, and he spent much of his time running legal interference, not only for explicit Nazi organizations, but for the leaderless resistance strategy. Details about that in For the Record 888, among other For the Record programs. We are also going to review some of the links between Team Trump and Narendra Modi and the RSS. Steve Bannon was an admirer of Narendra Modi. Some of Donald Trump's primary business contacts in India are members of the BJP, Narendra Modi's party, that again is a political front for the RSS. Much of the program, this program and parts of the next, are going to be from a long article from the New York Times Magazine of July 29th of 2017. It was authored by Robert F. Worth, W-O-R-T-H. It's called Baba Ramdev's Holy War. Baba is B-A-B-A. Ramdev, capital R-A-M-D-E-V, as in Victor. I'm going to read the entire article into the record. That will take most of this program. It may go into the next as well. Then I'm going to underscore some central points of the article, which in turn should help us, should resonate with some of our other examinations of various kinds of fascism. And in turn, we're going to talk about some similarities between the commercial empire of Baba Ramdev. He is a yoga maestro, so to speak, not only practices it, but has a very large and lucrative yoga business, and also, and perhaps even larger and more lucrative, Ayurvedic products business called Patanjali, capital P-A-T-A-N-J-A-L-I. They market Ayurvedic, unquote, foods, cosmetics, and medicines, cleaning products made from cow urine and other things. And we're going to talk about that. There are a number of things worth noting. There is an interesting similarity, I think, between Ramdev's fusion of religious ideology, political fascist ideology, and commercial entrepreneurship. It reminds me of the Unification Church of Reverend Sun Myung Moon. We have spoken about Moon's operations in numerous programs. In For the Record 970, we reviewed some comparisons of the Moon Operation, the Unification Church, to the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies. I think there are some interesting and, I believe, valid comparisons between Ramdev's Hindutva fascist undertakings and the Unification Church. We are going to look at the fusion as well of Ramdev's Patanjali Corporation with the Indian National Security Establishment, including the Indian Air Force. That will serve as something of a platform for discussion in part two, where we talk about the geopolitics of India and relate that to the anti-China policies of the U.S. military as well, and the Trump administration as well. Again, note the fundamental link between Baba Ramdev and his yoga and Ayurvedic products business and Narendra Modi's BJP and the RSS. Note the virulent anti-Muslim ideology of Modi and Ramdev and the RSS. Notice, too, the invocation of the idealized mythical past. One of the things that Ramdev is doing in combination with Modi and the RSS is moving to revamp the Indian educational system in such a way as the myths of the Hindu religion are going to be reconfigured as historical fact. We're also going to talk about how yoga fits in, or Ramdev's take on yoga fits into this, because although yoga, certainly as far as I can tell, all of the endorsements, the many and widespread endorsements of the health and psychological benefits of yoga are absolutely accurate. Yoga itself has an interesting history. It does not appear to have been a hand-down, so to speak, from ancient Vedic India, so much as something that evolved to a large extent anyway from various physical disciplines that were introduced from Europe in the 19th and early 20th centuries, including some key contributions to the physical disciplines of yoga by a Danish gymnast named Niels, N-I-E-L-S, Buch, B-U-K-H, who later became notorious for his pro-Nazi sympathies. We are also, in part two, going to take a look at an interesting link between the Nazi SS and the discipline of yoga, in addition to reviewing Niels Buch's Nazi sympathies. The SS and Heinrich Himmler saw themselves to an extent as the heirs of the Kshatriya warrior class of ancient India. And in fact, Heinrich Himmler carried around a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, and he saw yoga as something that could not only help his concentration camp guards and SS men de-stress, so to speak, but he saw it again as a direct link between this idealized mythical past, and the Nazi SS and Hindutva fascists have parts of this in common. The strain of Nazism we spoke about in, for the record, 992, and in some of our discussions with Peter Lavenda, what he termed esoteric Nazism, again, see the evolution of the, quote, Aryan race, unquote, as going back to ancient India, the Kshatriya warrior class, the, quote, Aryan race, unquote, and both Baba Ramdev and Heinrich Himmler see yoga as part of that idealized mythical past. And in fact, the discipline of yoga, and I do not want to be misunderstood as characterizing yoga as Nazi, but the discipline of yoga appears to have evolved in a more modern period, largely, again, from practices introduced into India under European auspices. It is interesting, I think, to note that Yoga became very popular in Weimar Germany. The German people, sick of war and stressed out by the profound political and sociological changes taking place in Germany, turned to yoga, among other things, in order to relieve their distress. Yoga became very popular in Weimar America as well. Weimar America, however, no longer exists. We are about in the same period as Germany was in 1934. It is no longer Weimar America. It is early Nazi America. And if that seems like a reach to you, well, just stick around, folks, and you're going to find out just how that works out. Note, with Ramdev, the fusion of his Hindutva fascist ideology, his virulent anti-Muslim sentiment, with that of Narendra Modi, the RSS, and the Indian state. Note, too, the profound benefits that have been conferred on Ramdev's Patanjali Corporation by Modi's government, which has given them some very good deals on land for development. And again, some of those in turn dovetail with Indian national security operations for the Indian Air Force. It reminds me a little bit of the land deals that Modi got. Reminds me a little bit of our discussion in For the Record 969 and 970 of the Moritomo Gakuin School, which appears to be a recapitulation of the patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies to an extent, and the favorable land deal they got for one of their schools, that on behalf of the Shinzo Abe government in Japan. We will touch on that briefly in the second part of our discussion. Again, this is much too tall a glass to drink at one sitting, so I'm going to go ahead and read into the record this long article, again, from the New York Times Magazine of Sunday, July 29th of 2017, Baba Ramdev's Holy War by Robert F. Wirth. We will then recap some key segments of this for purposes of emphasis, and then in turn we're going to offer up some supplemental discussion about the interesting and possibly relevant Nazi yoga connection, and some of the discussion of the links between Trump, Steve Bannon, and the Modi government, and also the interesting geopolitical aspects of Pierre Omidyar helping to finance the rise of the OUNB successor organizations in Ukraine, and also Narendra Modi's Hindutva fascist government in India as well. One of the key questions here, we're going to talk about the CV, the history of Baba Ramdev. There is a piece of missing history in his background. He left home for a Guru Kul, that is a monastic training school for aspirant Hindu monks. There is a missing piece of his history that seems blank, and he claims, that is to say, Baba Ramdev claims he can't remember what he was doing. I think it is important to contemplate where he was in those missing years, what he was doing, and in turn, given the huge lucrative scale of his business activities, which fuse with his religious and political fascist theocracy, who put forth the venture capital for Ramdev's businesses? You can't start a business from scratch, and his businesses have gotten very large indeed. Who put forth the venture capital to begin the Ramdev businesses? And in turn, did any of that capital, is there a link between who put forward the capital to begin his businesses and this missing period in his personal history. As we will see, Ramdev is suspected of some truly dark things. He has been suspected. He certainly has advocated between the lines of violence against some of his demonized Muslim opponents. And he also has been suspected of perpetrating violence against dissident members of his Patanjali company as well. So there are some dark suspicions that have followed Baba Ramdev. Some have suspected him of foul play, and we will talk about that later. Again, I'm going to read the whole article, and then probably in part two, maybe at the end of this program, I will review key sections of it.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Baba Ramdev's Holy War, Robert F. Worth, New York Times Magazine, July 29th of 2017. On a hazy day in early February, some of the most powerful men in India's government gathered at Shatrasal Stadium in New Delhi, an arena famous for its boisterous wrestling bouts. The men had come for a different kind of spectacle, a biographical film epic whose initial episodes, out of 57 total, would be shown for the first time that evening. At the center of a makeshift stage surrounded by smiling politicians and cabinet members was the person whose life was being celebrated, a slender figure in saffron robes with a long, dark beard, his chest-length hair tied in a bun. He needed no introduction. This was Baba Ramdev, again, capital B-A-B-A, capital R-A-N-D-E-V, one of the most famous men in India. Ramdev took the microphone and introduced the phalanx of several hundred Hindu religious students known as Brahmacharis sitting in neat rows on the field. "Everyone repeat after me. Bharat Mata Ki Jai," he shouted. The crowd raised their arms and pumped their fists as they chanted the words, "India, my motherland, is great," that have become a defining slogan of the Hindu nationalist movement. Many mass political movements do this. People love this sort of thing. And indeed, digressing slightly, the word fascism derives from the Roman fascus, or the symbol of the Roman Republic. That was a bundle of sticks tied together with an axe head. It has the same Latin derivation as the word fascinate. And if you think about all sorts of mass phenomenon, sporting events, rock concerts, they have some things in common with a fascist political rally from a psychosocial sense. And that is the case here. I think that Baba Ramdev's working up of the crowd is a picture of Baba Ramdev that will accompany the written description for this program. It shows a black headband tied around his head and a black wristband as he pumps his fist in the air. That black is symbolic of the RSS. That, again, is an explicitly fascist, in this case Hindutva fascist organization that is modeled after Mussolini's black shirt. Ramdev took the microphone and introduced the phalanx of several hundred Hindu religious students known as Brahmacharis sitting in neat rows on the field. "Everyone repeat after me. Bharat Mata Ki Jai," he shouted. The crowd raised their arms and pumped their fists as they chanted the words, "India, my motherland is great," that had become a defining slogan of the Hindu nationalist movement. One by one, the dignitaries rose to recount Ramdev's extraordinary career, how he brought physical fitness to the Indian middle class with his mass yoga camps and television empire, how he built his medicine and consumer goods company, Patanjali Ayurveda, into a multi-billion dollar colossus. Quote, "Swamiji has changed the direction of the world. the thinking of the world, one speaker shouted, referring to Ramdev with an affectionate honorific. That is how great he is. Swamiji has changed India, which was going toward the West, its dress and food and culture, and has changed its direction to yoga. At last, silence fell, and the 50-foot screen flickered to life. For the next hour, India's political elite watched in humble silence as Ramdev's life unfolded from his birth in a remote rural village to his early days as a lissom yogi. The remaining episodes had been condensed into trailer form. As a film, it was a shambolic melodrama that seemed to treat Ramdev almost as a divine messenger. But as an expression of the Indian public's feelings, it wasn't far off the remark. We're going to get into that. Something I forgot to mention, too, is that Ramdev calls his political and economic philosophy economic nationalism. I think in that regard, it is not unfair to see resonance between economic nationalism, the economic nationalism of Ramdev and the corporate state of Mussolini or the national socialism of Hitler. More about that later. Continuing. Ramdev has been compared to Billy Graham, the Southern Baptist firebrand who advised several American presidents and energized the Christian right. The parallel makes some sense. Ramdev has been a prominent voice on the Hindu right, and his tacit endorsement during the landmark 2014 campaign helped bring Prime Minister Narendra Modi to power. He appeared alongside Modi on several occasions, singing the leader's praises and urging Indians to turn out for him. Ramdev has called Modi a close friend, unquote, and the Prime Minister publicly loves Patanjali's array of Ayurvedic products, medicines, cosmetics, and foodstuffs. Although Modi campaigned heavily on promises to reform India's economy and fight corruption, there were frequent dog whistles to the Hindu nationalist base, some of them coordinated with Ramdev. A month after Modi's landslide victory, a trust controlled by Ramdev released a video in which senior leaders of Modi's party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, including the current ministers of foreign affairs, internal security, finance, and transportation, appeared alongside him with a signed document setting out 9 pledges. Interrupting briefly, Jayant Sinha, the finance minister of Modi's government, was formerly the director of Omidyar Network in India. That is Pierre Omidyar's, quote, charitable, unquote, operation in India. One of the main vehicles for the realization of said charity was the Lambesa organization that has a history going back to the Phoenix program in Vietnam. The director of Lambesa is Roy Fosterman. We've talked about that in For the Record 989, among other programs. Jayant Sinha then became an acolyte, basically visited congratulations. He garlanded some convicted cow vigilantes. That we talked about that in 1015. These are people who took vigilante violence against alleged killers of cows and or eating of beef, which is sacrilegious to Hindus. Mostly Muslims and lower caste Hindus eat beef in India. And again, as we spoke about in 1015 and again in 1016, there have been a number of vigilante killings of alleged killers of cows and eaters of beef in India. When an alleged trafficker in beef was murdered by a vigilante mob, Jayant Sinha, the finance minister of Modi's government, the former director of Omidyar Network, basically garlanded the convicted killers. Again, a discussion of that in For the Record 1015.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Resuming with this. Wamdev released a video in which senior leaders of Modi's party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, including the current ministers of foreign affairs, internal security, finance, and transportation, appeared alongside him with a signed document setting out 9 pledges. These included the protection of cows, animals held sacred in Hinduism, and a broad call for Hindu nationalist reforms of the government, the courts, cultural institutions, and education. After Modi won, Wamdev claimed to have, quote, prepared the ground for the big political changes that occurred, unquote. But Wamdev is far more than a useful holy man. Even beyond his political patrons, Wamdev is the perfect messenger for a rising middle class that is hungry for religious assertion and fed up with the socialist, nationalist legacy of Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first post-independence leader. Wamdev has led vastly popular campaigns against corruption, donning the mantle of Swadeshi, Swadeshi, or Indian economic nationalism, again, corporate state, national socialism, I don't think are unfair comparisons here, to cast foreign companies as neo-colonial villains. Think about Donald Trump, by the way. In a sense, Wamdev has changed Hinduism itself. His blend of patriotic fervor, health, and religious piety flows seamlessly into the dark, harder visions of Hindu nationalism, which are openly hostile to India's 172 million Muslims. Although Wamdev prefers to speak of Indian solidarity, his BJP allies routinely invoke an Islamic threat and rally crowds with vows to build temples on the sites of medieval mosques. In his own way, Wamdev is India's answer to Donald Trump, and there is much speculation that he may run for prime minister himself. Like Trump, he heads a multi-billion-dollar empire. And like Trump himself, he is a bombastic TV personality whose relationship with truth is elastic. He cannot resist a brandishing opportunity. His name and face are everywhere in India. In May, he announced plans to add Swadeshi SIM cards to his ever-growing list of products, packaged noodles, herbal constipation remedies, floor cleaner made with cow urine. He has a gift for WWE-style public stunts. Last year, he, quote, won, unquote, televised bout with an Olympic wrestler from Ukraine. A little bit more about that later. By the way, that video is online, and it's a joke. The Ukrainian Olympic wrestler can't suppress a smile in the whole thing as he gets, quote, beaten, unquote, by Wamdev. More about that later. On the surface, Wamdev's blissful demeanor is worlds away from Trump's growls and sneers. But his namastes provide cover for a reactionary campaign to transform the entire country. When challenged on his evasions and slurs, Wamdev, like the White House's current occupant, tends to respond by pointing a finger at, quote, corrupt, unquote, figures in the secular elite. It seems to work. Last year, an Indian judge banned a critical biography of Wamdev before it was released and then put a gag order on its author, barring her from even mentioning the book on social media. One more time, because for free speech advocates, I think this is worth noting. Wamdev, like the White House's current occupant, tends to respond by pointing a finger at, quote, corrupt, unquote, figures in the secular elite. It seems to work. Last year, an Indian judge banned a critical biography of Wamdev before it was released and then put a gag order on its author, barring her from even mentioning the book on social media. In a sense, Wamdev is more powerful than any prime minister. He may be a wholly new breed, a populist tycoon, protected from critics and even to some extent from the law by a vast following and a claim to holy purpose. The center of Ramdev's empire is in Haridwar, H-A-R-I-D-W-A-R, a small city on the Ganges near the foothills of the Himalayas, about a four-hour drive northeast of Delhi. It is a sacred place in Hindu legend, and thousands of pilgrims gather there by the riverbanks every day. Not far away is the town of Rishikesh, where the Beatles famously visited Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in the 1960s. But Ramdev's operation is a far cry from the ascetic ashrams of yesteryear. Patanjali's main office complex looks like an airport, with an odd pagoda-like gate separating it from the rest of town. Inside, there are vast parking lots, a cavernous employee cafeteria. Boy, there's a Freudian slip. I'm beginning again. But Ramdev's operation is a far cry from the ascetic ashrams of yesteryear. Patanjali's main office complex looks like an airport, with an odd pagoda-like gate separating it from the rest of the town. Inside, there are vast parking lots, a cavernous employee cafeteria, lawns, and fountains. You might think you were in Silicon Valley if not for the jerseys reading Department of Yoga Science, unquote, that the University of Patanjali students wear. I found myself staring at a statue of a bony, bearded sage seated in the lotus position. It was Patanjali, the company's namesake, who some two millenniums ago is said to have compiled the verses that are the foundation of modern yoga practice. Ramdev himself lives a few blocks away behind another huge gate manned by armed guards. After Modi's election, his government granted Ramdev the second highest level of state security while withdrawing it from some leaders of the rival Congress Party. By the way, note that there have been as yet unsolved murders of political critics and reporters in India, people who have criticized Modi and the RSS. We spoke about that in For the Record 990. The guards waved us through, and suddenly I found myself in a quiet enclave of lush gardens. The heat and dust of India seemed far away. We strolled along a brick path to a small bungalow, and there was Ramdev seated on a beautifully carved wooden swing, laughing and chatting with a guest. He rose and greeted me with a hug. I was struck by his slight stature. His bushy black beard, gray at the fringes, seemed more substantial than his thin frame. He emanated a loose-jointed warmth like someone who has just run a long distance. Apart from his thin saffron robes, one wrapped around his chest and one at the waist, he wore only padukas, the traditional platform wooden clogs with a metal post for the toes to grip. "This is my basic and ultimate mission," he said, speaking in strongly accented English. "I want a healthy, wealthy, prosperous and peaceful person, society, and nation," unquote. He looked into my eyes and touched my forearm as he spoke. The left side of his face was paralyzed by a childhood illness, and the resulting squint gives him a look of cockeyed intensity. "Health and happiness without yoga you cannot achieve," he went on. "Yoga is my basic work." Ramdev practices and teaches yoga every day from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. in a hangar-like auditorium with hundreds of students and TV cameras rolling, and then again when he can in the afternoon and evening from 5 until 7:30. In between, he told me, he oversees Patanjali and its associated trusts and charitable activities. He interspersed his earnest yoga talk with playful banter, tossing his head back in giddy fits of giggling. When I asked him if I could follow him around for a day or two, he seemed delighted. "Of course, you can stay with me," he said, gesturing at the house behind us, where he sleeps on a pallet on the floor. "I am not married, but don't worry, I am not homosexual," unquote. He burst into raucous laughter and added, "I'm against homosexuality," unquote. The laughter got even louder, and he added under his breath, "Just kidding," unquote. I was baffled for a moment, and then found myself marveling at his legerdemain. As a Hindu monk, Ramdev has repeatedly declared his disapproval of homosexuality, calling it immoral and unnatural. He says homosexuality can be cured by yoga. By the way, not unlike the way some fundamentalist Christians claim that there is a therapy to cure, quote, cure, unquote, people from being gay. Continuing. But Ramdev has the politician's gift for charming his audience. In a single East meets West moment, he had both deferred to tradition and hinted to me that he was a closet liberal. He was also kidding about the offer to sleep on his floor, as it turned out. Ramdev's informality and practical bent set him apart from most other gurus. Indian religious celebrities are known popularly as godmen, a word that suggests stardom but also adds a hint of derision. They are heirs to an ancient tradition of humble, loincloth-clad wisdom seekers, but seems to come with the territory as well. Some godmen had become immensely rich and built cults of personality that stretched around the globe. They tend to surround themselves with fawning followers, and many claim to perform miracles like Satya Sai Baba, who became notorious in the 1960s for conjuring Omega watches out of thin air. Ramdev is not the first one to gain influence in politics. In the 1970s, Indira Gandhi often sought advice from her own yoga teacher, who became known as the Rasputin of Delhi, unquote. But Ramdev rarely clouds the air with talk about enlightenment and religion. Quote, "My yoga is very simple," he told me. "No critical postures, no philosophy or ideology. All yoga practices are based on benefit, instant benefit," unquote. Ramdev is also the first godman to earn his millions as a businessman, and said instead of just siphoning donations from wealthy followers. Patanjali has vaulted in just over a decade from a tiny operation into an economic powerhouse with $1.6 billion in sales in the current fiscal year. Turn on a TV or glance at a billboard almost anywhere in India, and you are likely to see Ramdev advertising one of its products. During our talk, Ramdev boasted of Patanjali's success, detailing his plans for expansion and saying he aimed to reach about $15 billion in annual sales by 2025, a figure that would make Patanjali one of India's biggest companies. But he also insisted that Patanjali is not a business at all. It is, quote, "a service for humanity, for the nation," unquote. He maintains that neither he nor the company's CEO, Acharya Balkrishna, takes a salary. Ramdev says he doesn't even have a bank account. He abides by the monk's vow of austerity and chastity, though the company seems to more than take care of his needs. This last sentence again. Ramdev says he doesn't even have a bank account. He abides by the monk's vow of austerity and chastity, though the company seems to more than take care of his needs. All profits, he said, are plowed back into research and charity, and the company's low costs allow it to undersell competitors. Most of Patanjali's employees are paid less than they would receive elsewhere. Asking for a raise is taboo. A company spokesman denies this. Employees are forbidden to drink alcohol or eat non-vegetarian food. Quote, "Penance in individual life prosperity for others, von Depp told me with a smile. This blend of fierce capitalism and monkish renunciation is aimed at making India a, quote, world economic power and world spiritual power by 2050. Von Depp told me his nationalist vision embraces all religions and castes, but he added a revealing caveat. Country first, he said. This is a must. Not I'm great, my caste is great, but my country is great. Unlike Muslim leaders, they say Islam is great. I say, no, the nation is great, the citizen is great. And the nation, in Ramdev's telling, is subtly twinned with a history and culture that is distinctly Hindu. Yoga, Ayurvedic medicine, and the ancient Vedic scriptures from which they are said to have emerged. Sometimes the hints are not so subtle. 2 years ago, when a Muslim politician refused to chant a nationalist slogan, Ram Dev laid into him at a right-wing rally saying that were it not for his respect for the law, quote, we would behead hundreds of thousands of such people. A court later issued a warrant for Ramdev's arrest, though the matter appears to have been dropped. Hindu nationalism rarely made headlines in the West until the 1990s, when images of communal riots and chanting BJP supporters introduced many Americans to the idea that there was another, different kind of fundamentalism to worry about in South Asia. But as a political force, Hindu nationalism predates India's independence in 1947 and reflects centuries of resentment among the subcontinent's Hindu majority. Hindus submitted reluctantly to waves of Muslim conquest from the north starting almost 1,000 years ago and then to almost 300 years of British domination. After World War I, when the British Empire started to crack, some Hindu ideologues saw an opportunity to regain the upper hand. They began calling for an explicitly Hindu state and society in which Muslims and other minorities could be tolerated only if they respected the majority culture. In one respect, it was an effort to counter political Islam, which was already gaining adherence in India and elsewhere in the early 1920s. But building a cohesive moment was not easy. Classical Hinduism is more a conglomerate of sects than a single religion. It has many ancient scriptures, but no single foundational text like the Bible or the Quran. Its ancient caste hierarchy perpetuated divisions and did not translate easily into the unifying slogans of modern mass politics. In an effort to overcome these internal fissures, the early Hindu nationalists built a regimented anti-colonial social movement in the 1920s, which later formed links with Italian and German fascism. The main branch was known as the RSS, from the Hindu words for Nationalist Organization of Volunteers, unquote. In place of black shirts and armbands, they wore khaki shorts and carried bamboo sticks. This association painted them in the decades that followed, especially after so many British and Indian soldiers died fighting the Axis powers in World War II. Another serious blow came in 1948 when the Hindu nationalist zealot assassinated Mohandas Gandhi, modern India's saintly father figure. Parenthetically, he was not a lone nut. Rather, he was operating on Natarajan Godse, was operating on the explicit instructions of V.D. Savarkar and the RSS, and it was covered up by RSS and Hindu Mahasabha influence within the Indian National Security Establishment. Continuing. We looked at that in For the Record 988 and 989. After Gandhi's assassination, Nehru, Gandhi's political heir, suppressed Hindu nationalist organizations and fostered his own countervailing conception of India as a pluralist, secular state. Although he was a Brahmin, Nehru was a passionate cosmopolitan who saw Hindu identity as narrow and tribal. He wanted India to be defined by its diversity, not by any one faith. It was an idea shaped in part by his British education in Harrow, Cambridge, and the Inns of Court in London, and one shared by many of his peers. For decades after independence, India's ruling class was mostly, quote, a thin layer of brown Englishmen, unquote, in the phrase of an Indian friend of mine who heard it from his grandfather, who was a friend of Nehru's. They were patrician figures who rebelled successfully against the British and absorbed many of their ideas about how the country should be governed. By the 1990s, Nehru's Congress Party had become almost synonymous with the Indian state, but his tolerant, worldly vision was starting to fray. The Hindu nationalist movement anointed the BJP as its political vehicle, and the party slowly gained strength. Fueled by perceptions of corruption and entitlement in the secular political elite, by the way, beginning in this last sentence, the Hindu nationalist movement anointed the BJP as its political vehicle, and the party slowly gained strength, fueled by perceptions of corruption and entitlement in the secular political elite. In 1998, the BJP was able to sustain a majority coalition in India's parliament for the first time. But in early 2002, bloody communal riots broke out in the western state of Gujarat, reviving the party's old demons. It started when a train carrying some Hindu pilgrims caught fire. Revenge mobs quickly formed. In the ensuing violence, more than 1,000 people were killed, most of them Muslims, and there was widespread looting. Ramdev's future friend Narendra Modi was Gujarat's chief minister at the time, and evidence soon emerged suggesting that he and other top BJP officials had stoked the violence, or at least given a green light. Parenthetically, I would reject. I've never seen anything about the fire carrying the Hindu pilgrims. I wonder, and this is pure speculation, about the possibility of that being a provocation. Again, pure rumination. Continuing. A court-appointed investigation of the violence cleared Modi of wrongdoing in 2012, but many scholars and analysts who have examined the evidence disagree. Many Indian Muslims still consider the riots as a state-sanctioned pogrom and see Modi, who has never apologized for his role, as a criminal. But even among Hindus, the BJP suffered from its reputation as a party led by Brahmins and other upper-caste Hindus. It had trouble winning votes from Dalits, the untouchables, and others at the lower end of India's caste hierarchy. Baba Ramdev was just the kind of unifying figure the BJP needed. By the way, I would note that the common, unquote, origins, I don't like the word, but it is significant, of Baba Ramdev, is similar in some ways to the perception of Adolf Hitler, who was seen as not a member of the elite, but as a, quote, common person, unquote. In fact, he was an undercover operative for the political department of the Reichswehr, the German army, under General von Lassa. I would look at that in a miscellaneous archive show about the origins of the Nazi Party.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Continuing. At the time of the Gujarat riots, Ramdev was emerging as a celebrity, crisscrossing India to preside over mass yoga camps and pitch his home remedies. He tapped into a hunger for spirituality and health among India's growing middle class and quickly became a symbol of Hinduism at its most benign. A ready-made package of rituals and foods that were fun, affordable, and good for you. As his fame spread, a stream of politicians and celebrities made their way to Haridwar, eager to donate to his cause and seek his endorsement. He was becoming what Indians call a vote bank, unquote. In 2011, he embraced the nationwide anti-corruption movement led by the independent social activist Anna Hazare, H-A-Z-A-R-E, which swept India that year. In June, he started a hunger strike against corruption, and 40,000 of his followers rallied in his support in Delhi. The police showed up with tear gas, and in the ensuing melee, Ramdev shed his saffron robes under a stage and tried to escape disguised as an injured woman, only to be detained and exposed on video, bushy beard and all. The Indian press mocked him for days. But nothing seems to taint Ramdev for long. 3 years later, his reputation as a crusader against corruption, a frequent BJP talking point, made him even more valuable in the elections that swept the Hindu nationalists to power. He turned his yoga camp meetings, which often had tens of thousands of people in attendance, into unofficial rallies. 2 weeks before the elections started, he welcomed Modi on stage at a huge outdoor gathering in New Delhi. "You will make other people understand, won't you?" Ramdev said to the microphone as Modi sat next to him, grinning. "You won't sit at home, will you?" The audience roared back, "No." Ramdev founded a short-lived political party in 2010 and has since been rumored to be weighing a political career himself. When I brought up the question, he smilingly batted it away, saying that he'd become a, quote, non-political person, unquote, and that the triumph of the BJP had obviated any need for him to run for office. "Modi is an honest prime minister," he told me. "He is a visionary and a missionary. He will win the next term in the 2019 elections. He will build a strong foundation for India," unquote. But the BJP's ambitions go well beyond 2019. Unlike the Congress Party, the BJP does not just want to govern. It wants to transform the country politically and culturally. The Indian state and its business allies have become increasingly enmeshed in Hindu religious education and promotion, funding ashrams, guru kuls, where students apprentice themselves to a guru and study Sanskrit, and priest education. Modi's government has also helped empower figures like Jyoti Adityanath, a right-wing Hindu firebrand who has said he wants to install statues of Hindu gods in every mosque, and who last year became chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, India's most populous state. But we spoke about him in For the Record 990. Many Indian Muslims say they have begun to feel like strangers in their own land. The BJP has proposed a number of laws with a troublingly sectarian cast. One of them would allow immigrants from nearby countries who are Hindu, Buddhist, Sikh, or Christian to apply for citizenship, but would explicitly exclude Muslims. Even worse, some Muslims say, the government's winking attitude toward communal... winking attitude toward communal violence. We're going to continue with the reading of this article in our next program. This actually might go a total of 3 programs because of the geopolitical implications of this, I think, need underscoring. We've been reading from Baba Ramdev's Holy War by Robert F. Worth from the New York Times Magazine of Sunday, July 29th of 2018. This concludes For the Record 1018, Baba Ramdev and Hindutva Fascism Part 1, being recorded on August 7th of 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.